White House Economic Advisor Gary Cohn took to the podium in the press room today talking taxes.
You have to look at this plan in its entirety. The one thing I would beg you all to do is don't look at any one piece. Look at the plan in its entirety.
Yeah, but Gary, it's like a $2 trillion plan. Man, we are going to have to break it down for people. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 28th of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Notwithstanding that plea from President Trump's chief economic advisor to examine the GOP's tax plan in its entirety, that is just not going to work for us. Way too many moving parts and way too many things we still don't know. Like, for instance, who wins and who loses. Both Gary Cohn at the White House today.
Our tax plan is aimed at making sure we give middle-class Americans a tax cut. We are going to give middle-class Americans a tax cut. That is what we are spending all of our time on doing.
And Speaker of the House Paul Ryan on Fox News last night.
Here's what this is about. This is about delivering middle-class taxpayers tax relief. There are a lot of people in this country working paycheck to paycheck. A lot of people in this country, because of the slow growth economy we had in the Obama years, never got a raise. A lot of economic anxiety. So this is really about them.
They both seem to be sharing the same set of middle-class talking points. But just because they say it does not make it true. Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us going with what we know about the middle-class part of this tax plan.
Agreement. I have found it on the tax code from tax experts on the left, right, middle. Turns out, if you look at the GOP tax framework as written, no one can tell you what exactly it'll mean for the middle class.
It could be that middle class families see their tax bills lowered. It could be that middle class families see their tax bills increased.
Michael Strain is an economist at the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute. To figure out if the middle class benefits or not, there are a whole lot of big deal things that have got to be figured out.
These are really kind of first order pieces of information that we don't have.
For example, we know the framework proposes three tax rates, 12%, 25%, 35%, but we don't know what income brackets those rates apply to.
The answer to that question turns out to be really important when you're trying to figure out who wins and who loses.
Howard Gleckman is at the Tax Policy Center. If the 12% bracket tops out at $10,000, that's a whole lot different than if it tops out at $100,000. We also know the framework says the child tax credit will go up, but we don't know by how much. For all the known unknowns, when you look broadly at the framework, says NYU law professor Lily Batchelder, who served on President Obama's National Economic Council.
I don't think it's at all plausible to say that this is a plan that is primarily benefiting the middle class.
I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
So let's move up the tax brackets then, shall we, and talk about the top end. President Trump and Gary Cohn and this morning Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, again on Fox, by the way, said this plan isn't going to be a tax cut for the rich.
It's not a tax cut for the rich. And as the president has said, he's focused on income taxes and the wealthy not going down. And we've been working on that. We'll continue to work with Congress on it.
Fact check, anyone? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has it.
So, yeah, there's a lot we don't know about President Trump's tax proposal. But here's what we do know, according to Edward Kleinbard, a law professor at the University of Southern California.
Just about the only thing that we know for sure is that it will be of immense benefit to the wealthy.
To start, this proposal drops the top income tax rate by almost 5 percentage points. It eliminates the estate tax, which only kicks in for people whose estates are worth north of $5.5 million. It also eliminates the alternative minimum tax, which was designed to make sure higher-income folks with lots of deductions pay some minimum tax level. We don't yet fully know how Republicans will pay for these tax cuts, but even getting rid of deductions and closing loopholes, totally zeroing out these big benefits to the rich, would be tricky, says Joel Slemrod. He's a professor of economics at the University of Michigan.
It's going to be pretty darn hard to come up with a tax bill that isn't a significant tax break for high-income people.
Even lowering the corporate tax rate, that typically benefits corporate owners and investors who tend to be wealthy. But Republicans have left themselves a little wiggle room, says Nicole Duran, a senior politics and government editor at Kiplinger.
They may create a fourth tax bracket that could put the top 1% into this new undefined fourth bracket. That is a possibility.
It's another one of those. We'll have to wait and see. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
So far today, we have done changes to the individual tax code, but there's a whole slew of stuff going on the corporate side at the same time. Something called, in the vernacular, pass-through is a big one. Businesses owned usually by a single person or a couple of people where the business's profits are passed through to the owner. And here's the key, taxed at less than the standard corporate rate. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains this particular line item.
Right now, if I own a pass-through business, I don't know, a consulting firm, the profits for my business are taxed like my income. If I make a lot of money, my top tax rate could be north of 35%. Under the GOP plan, pass-through businesses would be taxed at just 25%. Got that? Income taxed at 35%. Pass-through business income, 25%.
The problem with that is it's easy to start recharacterizing all sorts of income as pass-through income.
Joe Thorndike is with Tax Analysts. It's pretty easy for doctors, lawyers, accountants, real estate moguls to say, come tax time, no, 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 IRS, this money isn't my salary that you want to tax at sky-high rates. This is my profits from my business. Business profits. Give me the better tax rate.
That's what happened in Kansas.
In 2012, that state eliminated taxes on pass-through businesses. And gee, what did people do?
We find people recharacterizing income that would have been wages as pass-through business income to get the preferential rate.
Bradley Heim is a professor at Indiana University. He studied the Kansas case. People just reclassified themselves. The state lost millions. The White House says there will be rules put in place to make abuse like this more difficult.
That's really hard to do.
Stephen Bank teaches law at UCLA. It's also costly to enforce. Scott Drankard is an economist with the Tax Foundation.
Is this even something that we want in terms of the compliance costs and then also the cost of conducting audits?
You know what Kansas ended up doing with its tax break for pass-through businesses? Repealing it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street today not quite as enthusiastic on Tax Day Plus One. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Eight days after Hurricane Maria walloped Puerto Rico, two key developments to pass on today. Number one, the president bowed to pressure from Congress and others and has decided to allow foreign ships to take aid to the island. And the Pentagon has put a three-star Army general in charge of the military's relief work there. But why has all this taken so long, and will today's events make things move faster? The answer, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, depends on who you ask.
More ships can now get to Puerto Rico, thanks to a new waiver of a law known as the Jones Act. But Jose Ayala in San Juan Port doesn't care. He's with the shipping and logistics company Crowley, and he says ships are not the problem.
It's the interruption of distribution portion on the island. So you can give a waiver to the Jones Act for what? We have 10,000 containers sitting here in the ports.
The issue is the stuff can't get to the people. The roads are out, truckers can't get to work or even call into work with almost all communications out. And then there's fuel, says Tom Cotter of the relief group AmeriCares, from a dodgy phone line in Puerto Rico.
We have had a team member have to stay in line for hours just to fuel up our cars so we can go visit clinics. The hospitals in the area are all on generator power, and they are all in need of diesel.
The U.S. military says its focus has now shifted to land-based help, clearing roads, delivering water and generators for electricity. But retired Army officer Philip Carter, now at the Center for New American Security, says the help began too late and that 15 or 20 relief flights per day is not enough.
It's clear that the military did not pre-mobilize resources. The military had committed so much to the Harvey and the Irma responses that it was out of schlitz for some of these other types of responses that it's now had to catch up for.
And now, after pleas for medical help, the Navy is sending over a hospital ship once it loads up with crew and supplies. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's a shortage of affordable housing in a whole lot of cities in this country, and that is changing a lot of those cities. Rising property values attract different kinds of buyers, and developers see retail opportunities where none used to be. Here in Los Angeles, a lot of the historically working-class Latino neighborhoods in East L.A. are staring gentrification like that right in the face, and they are fighting back. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
Got it?
As the Eastside Cafe in El Sereno welcomes visitors for an art exhibition on a recent evening, Roberto Flores motions to the donation jar on a table out front.
By the way, we don't charge here for anything.
There's no coffee here because this place isn't really a cafe. It's a community organizing space inspired by the Zapatistas, a Mexican indigenous revolutionary group whose art hangs on the walls tonight. Flores says they host everything from English classes to a traditional Mexican folk music circle. It's all focused on renewing the communal identity of this 80% Latino neighborhood.
We are in favor of reconstructing our community. The flip side of that is that we don't like gentrification. We don't like displacement.
Roberto's daughter, Angela, puts on renters' rights workshops here and started an anti-gentrification group 3 years ago.
I started to feel like that's probably going to hit El Sereno soon, and I could see it in the residential areas where there's a lot of these restorations and for sale signs on people's homes.
In May of this year, those gentrification forces came knocking on the Eastside Cafe's door. The group discovered a strip mall developer had begun the process of buying the building they rent from for more than $1 million. When the prospective buyer came for a walkthrough, Roberto says they confronted him.
Invited him in, sat him down, showed him a video of what we do here. We asked him if he was conscious of, you know, that he was going to be destroying a whole lot and that he was going to be doing it to make profits.
They told the guy they weren't going to go quietly, and so he left to think it over. And then
he came back and said, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you guys 10 days to come up with a bona fide offer. But if you don't come up with a bona fide offer, then I am going to buy it, and I don't want you guys chasing me around.
They figured they needed about $200,000 for a down payment to offer the landlord. No one person had that kind of money, but Flores had always dreamed of the community itself owning the place. So he put the word out for contributions. The next day, musician couple Allo Black and Maya Jupiter took up the cause. They gave $60,000 and posted a video on Facebook.
There are other buyers waiting in the wings, and a developer wants to buy the building, and the Eastside Cafe has 9 days to get in front of him.
9 days.
More money started coming in. By the time 10 days were up, they'd raised $120,000, enough to open escrow on the building and get the other buyer to walk away. They're still fundraising for the rest, but are on their way to owning the building. It's been all hands on deck, says Eastside Cafe regular Nati Carrera.
We've kind of had to learn a lot really fast about real estate, and we've been reaching out to people like lawyers and foundations. So we've kind of like really ramped up our knowledge base to purchase the building.
There's one irony here. With six other stores in the building, Roberto Flores and the Eastside Cafe will be in the awkward position of being landlords.
We want to make sure that we are able to sustain this place and not have to raise rents in a shocking way that is going to displace people. The whole effort is against gentrification, so we need a lot of help.
To bring in some revenue, the Eastside Cafe will finally start selling coffee, Zapatista-grown coffee from Chiapas, Mexico. But Angela Flores says this cafe won't be like the hip coffee shops opening nearby.
They're run as businesses, and we're going to have something like a co-op. It's going to be run by the community. I think people really want to see something like that here.
Something to serve the neighborhood, not change it. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Coming up,
to create technology so that others can create more technology. That's what I see.
Satya Nadella, part two. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 40 points today, about a 10%, 22,381 for the blue chips. NASDAQ up less than a point. We'll call that unchanged, 6453. S&P 500 up 3 points, about a 10%, 25 and 10 there. Busy week for a couple of medical device companies. Abbott Laboratories won FDA approval to start selling a new blood sugar monitor for people with diabetes that doesn't need backup fingerprint tests. Diagnostics company Alere agreed to pay $13 million to settle charges of accounting fraud and improper payments to foreign officials. And oh, by the by, Abbott won antitrust approval today to buy Alere. And thus you get this, Abbott Labs up 2.8%, Alere up 3.7% today because capitalism. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The economy, as we've said more than once, isn't just about the statistics you see in the headlines. It's about people and their experiences living in the everyday, experiences that we put on the radio in our series called My Economy. Here's today's installment.
My name is Pam Palm. I am a certified registered nurse anesthetist. In eighth grade, I spent a whole day with an anesthesiologist. I thought that's what I wanted to do for my whole life. But I have a learning disability and I have dyslexia. In high school, I did not do very well in science. I had a chemistry teacher who convinced me that I could not do science. I was failing chemistry, and he told me that if I promised not to take another science course, he would pass me. And so I did that, and I decided that science was not for me, and so medicine was not for me. My husband and I have known each other for a long time. And we were married very young, and we had our first child when I was 21 and he was 23. And so we struggled financially from the very get-go. I was at home with my kids and needing to have a job. At that time, I started nursing school. I was very scared, especially when I took my first chemistry class. The professor that was teaching the class knew the high school teacher that I had. And I told him the story, and he told me he actually failed chemistry in college, and I knew him back then. And so that gave me a great deal of hope in my future studies. You can't gain without taking a risk. If I had not taken the risk, I would not have been able to send my daughter to college, and she graduated debt-free because we were able to pay for it. You know, life is very good. I cannot ask for anything more.
We would love to hear your economic story. You can tell us at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Satya Nadella and I chatted about a whole bunch of stuff on the program yesterday. What the Microsoft CEO thinks about immigration and changes to the tax code, and how he goes about running a company that 42 years after it started had maybe gotten a bit long in the tooth. Nadella's new book is called Hit Refresh, and today part two from Microsoft headquarters up in Seattle.
Part of the, I guess, theory behind you doing this book is to lay out your vision for the future of this company. You talk a lot about cloud technology, which you ran before you got the top job. You talk about the HoloLens and augmented or mixed reality. A lot of talk about artificial intelligence here, which is all great and whiz-bang. I wonder, though, if getting those right makes up for you guys having missed mobile.
I mean, it's always the case when a company like ours that's been around for 42 years, and here we are competing with a whole lot of new people, and that means we got some things right and we may have missed some things. But the question is, if you miss something, you don't rue that fact. You really look at what's the next turn. We are very, very excited about the cloud. That's something that's really driving a lot of our current growth, by the way. And now I believe the next big waves are going to be these two, mixed reality and AI, and we definitely are on the forefront of it.
Paul Allen and Bill Gates, when they started this company, the mission was, in essence, a desktop on a computer on every desk, right? So that people would be connected and that would change the economy, which it has. With all of these things you're working on now, the cloud and the HoloLens and AR and all of that, what does it look like if you are as successful as Bill Gates and Paul Allen were 40 years ago?
Yeah, it's a, you know, when I joined the company, even as late as 1992, we used to talk about our mission as a PC in every home and every desk. Yeah. And just by even the end of that decade, at least in the developed world, we had pretty much accomplished, quote unquote, that mission. That's when it struck me that that was a goal
as opposed to a mission. Our goal from the very first day when Bill and Paul created the very first product that this company produced, which was the basic language interpreter for the Altair, was to create technology so that others can create more technology. That's what I see.
There's a moment in this book where you, well, I should back up here and explain that there's a not small part of this book that's personal, about your journey, about your family, and about your oldest son, Zane, who was born disabled with cerebral palsy, has required hospitalization and care. And there's a moment in the book where you were sitting in his hospital room one night.
That was much later because he's had many surgeries. And one night I was sitting in a hospital room and watching all of the machinery, all of these computers around the Children's Hospital in Seattle that, in fact, were running many of them Windows. And it hit home that the work we do here is so ingrained in our economy and in our society. And here it is, man, in his most perilous time, he's sitting, I mean, he's in a hospital bed managed with devices and software that we built.
It bears a mention here, and you say this in the book, I'm not making this up, you basically would not be here if it were not for your wife. And her having given up her career as an architect to care for the kids, including Zane and a daughter who's got some learning challenges. Talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. Anu is my life partner, and I've known her all my life. We grew up together. But for, quite frankly, the sacrifices she had to make, I wouldn't be here. She has been able to hold the front and home with Zane and all of the other challenges we face. But also, as someone who, through all of this, has helped me grow. She's the one who has influenced a lot of how I think on the most important topics.
One of the things that's big in tech right now, and has been for a number of years, but is becoming more pressing, is the issue of diversity and specifically women in technology. What is Microsoft's role in that, and how do we boost that pipeline? Because tech companies always say, oh, we don't have women in the pipeline, so you can't blame us if 4% of our engineers are women. How do we fix that?
Well, I mean, there's two sides to it, I think. One is we have to make it more amenable, inviting computer science as a curriculum. But the first place where I want us to, instead of worrying about the supply side, we at this company have to every day get better at the diversity and inclusiveness of the people who are already here. Because the best way we can make it more attractive for more women to join computer science, join companies like Microsoft, is for them to come here, thrive here, feel a sense of belonging and inclusion. That's, I think, what's the most important agenda I have in this company.
Do you feel like you have a clue as to what's going on down in the cubicles in Building 72 across the hall?
You know, one of the most intimidating things that I do is this town hall, which is a Skype broadcast where people can have live emojis, feedback, which is all anonymous, on what I'm saying. And I analyze it afterwards, how many thumbs up versus thumbs down I got. So, quite
frankly, is it really that easy, thumbs up or thumbs down?
And there's lots of other emotions, too, people express. But the idea—
Not necessarily emojis.
But, you know, it's always hard. You're absolutely right that being a CEO means that sometimes you get abstracted from what's happening. But I think the real power comes when you are able to synthesize, and there is— And it really is something that you have to take and make a conscious decision and take time on.
Satya Nadella, thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you missed part one on the air yesterday, we rolled the whole interview into one episode of our Corner Office podcast. Check it out. Final note on the way out today, a corporate merger that makes so much sense, it is not even funny. IKEA, the company that sells all that furniture that's really annoying to have to put together, announced today it's buying TaskRabbit, the gig economy company where you can hire people to get stuff done for you, like putting together really annoying IKEA furniture. We had Stacey Brown Philpott, by the way, the CEO of TaskRabbit, on the Corner Office podcast earlier this year. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 40 today, about a 10%. NASDAQ was unchanged. S&P 500 up 3 points, about a 10% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, still, is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. John's a good guy. This is APM.